Good morning, Tony.
How are you?
Yes, I'm good, thanks. Struggling with a bit of a cough, but apart from that, I'm good. So if your listeners will bear with me, we'll be fine.
As long as you've got the glass of water handy, that's all you need.
I certainly have.
Okay, been an interesting time. Last week, I mean, well, contrasting times, I think. Last week, of course, with many of the planets lining up in a line, we couldn't see it because of the sky, and it was that way. March, not good really for weather, so wasn't good for looking at the night sky.
No.
This week, though, a whole different thing. But can I start really by just asking you about this lineup of the planets? I mean, I don't know that anybody in this country saw it, and I'm pretty certain you didn't.
No, I didn't. But I do remember seeing it many years ago. And I went to a vantage point in the valley where we live, quite high up. And like this evening and tomorrow, beautiful, clear skies. And was able to see all five of them beautifully arcing across the sky. Fantastic. It would have been a good sight. It's very frustrating, the clouds and the rain, isn't it?
Now, since we last spoke, of course, we've gone through the solstice for the spring equinox.
Yes.
And of course, the sun has moved back into the northern hemisphere. And one of the things I'd like to do late at night is stand out and watch things go overhead. Mm-hmm. You know, the ISS and all that sort of stuff. You don't see that stuff in the winter, probably because the sun is that much lower down and it's actually in the southern hemisphere. But it's all coming.
You do see them, but not as much.
Yeah.
You get a pronounced increase in the number of satellites that you can see in the summer.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that's good to say. That's exactly as it appears to be. So, I mean, that also, apart from watching the natural things in the night sky, we can also see a lot of the not quite so natural things in the sky. But
indeed.
If we were to look up at the sky this week, what would we see?
In terms of artificial or?
No, the real things.
Oh, the real things.
Yeah.
Well, the stars and the planets. Planets are still up there, luckily. And the stars are coming into spring, of course. The spring will take us into the summer constellation, so the summer patterns of stars.
Yeah.
But also we have a meteor shower. We have the Lyrid meteor shower, which happens in April every year.
Yeah.
And Venus is going to be passing south of the Pleiades as well. So we can talk a little about those if you like.
Okay. Yeah. I was going to ask you, though, because we couldn't see the lineup of the planets last week. And you said if you look up, the planets are still there. But they're not in the same place as they were. I mean, I looked up last night. It was very clear.
Yes.
And I could see but one planet. With the naked eye.
That's probably Venus.
It was very bright.
Yes, in the west, low down.
Yeah, I think it was.
Yeah.
I mean,
Jupiter is actually below that, so Jupiter is below the horizon now.
So where are the others?
Well, they're still out there. They're on their way into re-emerging into the spring-summer sky. You just have to bear with them.
Oh, I was going to say, because we saw them all in the
Mercury's
line last
up
week.
As well.
And this is one of the wonders of looking up at the night sky. One minute they're there, the planets. The next minute they're not. But, of course, the stars are.
It takes a bit longer than that. Not literally one minute to the next, because you can't actually see them move from one,
well, give
one
it a few
night
hours.
To the next. It's actually Earth's rotation that leads you to think that they are moving swiftly against the background stars. It's actually the rotation of Earth that is creating that illusion.
All right.
But they're there, all eight of the classical planets. They're all there in their orbit around the sun. And, of course, it's dependent, obviously, on where they are and where we are in relation to them and the sun.
Oh, right. OK, so, yeah. I mean, this is where the whole subject becomes rather fascinating, and you have to understand all of the bits of this planet rotating, other planets rotating, and we're all,
rotating
around. Yeah, all rotating, some around each other and some going off elsewhere, I don't know. it's an awful lot to take in. So when are we likely to see? I mean, we saw that it was last week they're all in a line. How often does that actually happen?
Really only about every 100 years, really.
Wow.
That you get a good lineup like that. Well, all six, for example.
Yeah.
That is really about every 100 years. So it's quite rare. It was a long time ago, actually, that I saw all five of them lined up.
Yeah, it wasn't 100 years ago, obviously.
Not 100, no.
Yeah, Yeah, so it is such a rare thing. So it's such a shame that the weather was so bad last week that we couldn't actually get to see it.
Astronomy can be so annoying, really.
Yeah.
Because whenever you have something to look forward to, like an eclipse or a lunar eclipse,
yeah,
it's almost guaranteed to bring the clouds in. It really is.
Somebody told the weatherman.
We're good this week. So for your listeners, now is the time. It's warmer too. Now is the time to be stepping outside at night and looking up. Start
okay.
Now.
So so from this week, we've got the Lyrid meteor showers, haven't we?
Yes, yes. So for your listeners who may not be aware, a meteor shower, a meteor is another name for a shooting star. And you can see shooting stars all the time, twice as many after midnight as before. And a shooting star is simply where the dust and debris that is out beyond our planet in the solar system, it slams into our atmosphere, and as it does so, it vaporizes and creates that sort of streak of light, a shooting star. So that's what a meteor is. And at certain times of the year, we have a meteor shower, which means we have a shower of shooting stars.
Mm-hmm.
And that comes about because around our solar system and beyond, things like comets, for example, icy rocks, they come from beyond our solar system. They pass in our solar system, pass around the sun. Sometimes they don't make the passage around the sun and they're actually destroyed by the sun. But they can pass around the sun and loop back out again on their orbits. And as they travel around the sun, because of that vaporization, they have a tail created behind them. We've all seen comets with their tails. And that legacy tail is still there. So the tail itself loops through the solar system. And as Earth passes through that tail, at a fixed time each year, mm-hmm, a lot more material slams into the atmosphere, and that gives rise to a shower of shooting stars. So on the night of the 22nd, 23rd of April, we're going to have the Lyrids meteor shower, and it's called the Lyrids because the radiant position, the point from which the shooting stars appear to emanate, is in near the star Vega, which is in the constellation of Lyra. So that's where you need to be looking in the sky. But really, if you just sort of lay down on a lounger, wrap up warm, look up, you'll see more shooting stars. Now, it's not a hugely active meteor shower. You can hope to see probably 15 to 20 per hour, which isn't really that much. But you know, they can be quite spectacular, so it's worth taking a look.
Mm, does sound like it. You need your sleeping bag for that one, I think, really, because it's not that warm outside at night. So if you're going to lay down on the lounger and watch the sky, take your sleeping bag out with you. And, of course, your binoculars or your other sort of aids that you can view the night sky with. And, have fun with that one.
The naked eye as well. You don't need binoculars or a telescope. Just the naked eye. Just look up.
Lay back, relax and
see chill out. Have a flask of tea or coffee. There we go. Or something stronger.
Okay. Now, I've seen also that you've got down movement of Venus.
Yes,
as well.
Yes. So as you said, Tony, the planet Venus is still very, very bright in the west, and it's going to be passing south of something called the Pleiades, which is an open cluster of stars. Now, to the naked eye, it looks like there are seven main stars, which there are, but actually there's about 1,000 hot, luminous blue stars in this cluster of stars. You can't miss it. When you find the constellation of Taurus, the bull, there's like a V-shape of stars which marks the head. Venus will be passing south of that. So with the naked eye, you can see a cluster of stars. In binoculars, you can see many, many more. And it actually looks beautiful. It's passing through a cloud itself, a dust cloud. And the light from those main stars illuminates the dust cloud that it's passing through. Really, really stunning. So to see Venus passing south of that is really quite a sight. So if you have a pair of binoculars, better still a telescope, take a look.
I'm going to say, it is very, very bright in the sky at the moment. It's one of those things. And I often get confused with these because I can never quite remember the order in which they run. So it's the one... is that the one closest to Earth?
What, the Venus?
Yeah.
No. Mercury, Venus, then Earth, Mars, Jupiter,
it is the
Saturn,
one closest to Earth.
Uranus, Neptune.
Venus is closer to Earth than the others.
It's and Mars is actually as well. Mars, I forget the distances.
Well, they're either
Mars
side of Earth, aren't they?
We're sort of sandwiched between.
Yeah, so they would be the brightest stars because they're all brightest planets because they are the closest up, I suppose.
Not that they're particularly close. No, not really, Tony. No, got to pull you up on that
one.
It comes down to the atmosphere, mainly for Venus, for example. Venus is covered in a 40-mile thick layer of cloud. And unlike the stars, which produce their own heat and light, the reason why we see the planets is because they reflect the light that they see from the sun, predominantly. So with Venus, because it has this enormous thick layer of cloud covering the entire planet, it makes it highly reflective. So that's why it's so, so bright. Jupiter is bright, but it's, of course, it's much, much bigger than Earth, but it's much, much further away. So there's those kind of things that influence it.
Yeah.
Mostly it's distance.
And, of course, when you look at Mars, of course, has that slight orangey-red tint to it.
It does. And if you look outside tonight, you'll be able to see it.
Why is that? Why does it have that sort of... because I know it's known as the red planet, but why? What gives it that red glow from that distance?
Yeah, actually, it's the hematite on the surface, so it's like a rust colour. You find that the surface of Mars is actually sort of a orangey kind of colour, orange butterscotch orange. And that varies throughout the planet as well. So in some areas it's, you know, dark, but in other places it's kind of light. It's known for its dust storms. And you can have dust storms on Mars that actually effectively cover the entire planet.
Wow.
And then it will glow, you know, obviously much, much brighter.
It's fascinating, the little nuances of all of this stuff. And it's not quite just as simple as looking up in the sky and seeing these things.
No.
There's a lot more to understand than that.
They're all different and they're all fascinating and there's so much to know.
Yeah. Now I'm going to test you a little bit on this one.
Oh, no. Put me on the spot.
We like to do this. No, it's not really putting you on the spot. The full moon, of course, it's on April the 16th. It's known apparently as a pink moon. And it was given that description by Native American tribes because apparently it marked the appearance of moss pink.
Yes. Phlox or something, isn't it? Isn't that amazing?
Yeah,
isn't
it
that amazing? Yeah. They give them, of course, the Red Indian tribes used to give names to the moons throughout the year and other tribes all over the world as well. Yeah, it's interesting. And there's a lot of information about it.
I had no idea that Native American tribes had that much input into astronomy, but apparently they do. This particular moon, apparently known as the sprouting grass moon, the growing moon, and apparently the egg moon as well.
Oh, goodness.
Very, very different names and no particular reasons why. It's an interesting thing.
It is. For astronomers, though, the full moon, as lovely as it is a complete pain in the proverbial for us because it throws so much light you can't see the stars. We like a nice dark sky, so we like a new moon, i.e. when there's no moon visible at all.
Yeah, you'll see a lot more, I guess. But, surely there's an awful lot to learn from the moon, isn't there? Or have we gone as far as we can
goodness,
for the while?
Yes. Yes, and, you know, it's amazing, Tony, how many people I ask, you know, have you ever picked up a pair of binoculars and actually looked at the moon through them? And it's surprising how many people haven't. And I say, you know, you really must, because it brings it to life. I mean, the craters become so visible. You can see the mountains. Oh, it's just stunning. Absolutely stunning.
Of course.
Particularly when it's what we call a first quarter or a last quarter moon. So that's when, or crescent moon, you know, when only it's partially lit. If you look along the, what we call the terminator, so that's the line that delineates the dark area of the moon from the light. If you look down there, you can see the mountains through it. It's fantastic.
It sounds it. I mean, and there, of course, have been only ever been 12 men who have landed and walked on the moon. Turn that vision around a little bit. Those 12 men are the only people that have ever seen Earth from that perspective, from standing on a different body of whatever you want to call it, and looking back at, and look back and see the Earth.
Yes,
that's probably a very strange thing.
It is, but it's going to change too, isn't it? Because yesterday, I think it is, they announced the astronauts that are going to be going to the moon again, because we're going back to the moon in the Artemis mission. NASA's Artemis mission, Artemis 2.
Yeah.
So it's going to be the first crewed mission to going around the moon. So exciting times.
Yeah, of course, and talking of space travel and getting out to other planets and that, the space agency have a trip planned to Jupiter, don't they?
They do. The European Space Agency, so it's a European mission, which I'm very excited about. It's called JUICE, Jupiter Icy Moons Explorer. And this is a mission undertaken by the European Space Agency. And it's going to be launching on the 13th of April this month from the European Spaceport in French Guiana.
Oh.
So that's going to be an amazing mission. It's going to take about 7.5 years for this spacecraft to reach Jupiter. But when it does, its mission is to orbit 3 of the 4 Galilean moons. So the 4 Galilean moons are the largest of the, I think it's 92 moons that encircle Jupiter, so named by Galileo. And this mission is focusing on Ganymede, Europa and Callisto, 3 of those 4 Galilean moons, because after the Galileo missions of the 1990s, 2000, it's believed that there are underwater oceans on these moons. So we're going to go back there and use, I think, a suite of instruments to probe, analyse, take, use spectrometers to really delve in and find out if indeed there are oceans on these moons, which will be fantastic.
Yeah. You talk about that stuff and it kind of puts it into perspective that we really only are not even quite at the tip of a very giant iceberg, so to speak.
Gosh,
it's just enormous. It's enormous. Yeah. I was trying to be...
It takes me back, Tony, sorry to interrupt, but it takes me back to 1997.
Yeah.
And I was serving as an officer on a cruise ship at the time. And I remember that NASA was launching the Cassini-Huygens mission to Saturn. And I was in a meeting at the time and I thought, there's no way that I'm not going to see the launch of this rocket.
Mm.
And I remember I made an excuse to get out of the meeting, ran down to my cabin, flicked the TV remote on, and within about 20 seconds, I was able to watch the launch of that rocket. It was a nighttime launch.
Yeah.
But what was staggering about it was the fact that then it's like an enormous anticlimax, because I had to wait. I knew I'd have to wait 7 years for it to actually reach the planet Saturn. But what made that more staggering was the fact that relative to the Sun, the spacecraft was going to be travelling at 98,000 miles an hour. And with a few flybys, it was still going to take 7 years to get there.
That's amazing. Extraordinary. It does kind of put into perspective the enormity of the whole thing and the subject that we literally brush the surface of once a month. It truly is a fascinating subject. But right now, though, Jane, we have to call a halt to it for this month because we've run out of time.
Time rockets by.
It does indeed. Jane Green, thank you for talking to us this morning, and we will catch up with you again in a month's time.
That's a pleasure. Thank you, Tony.